Yes. So a little more than a decade ago, people started suspecting the existence of a different class of black holes, not stellar mass, not supermassive, intermediate mass, the Goldilocks of black holes, I guess you would call it. So I'll tell you a little bit about these things. I'll give a quick overview of some of the observational evidence that intermediate mass black holes exist, where the definition here would be hundreds to thousands of solar masses. I'll argue that these must be, if they're electromagnetically active, they must currently be in dense stellar systems. I'll talk a little bit about the dynamics. We heard a lot about that from Simone. Then I will go on to their possible residence in globular clusters, something which sort of follows on to what Carl Gebhardt was talking about, and how these might be detected in globulars. It turns out to be more difficult than you might think. But one interesting prospect is that these might produce unique types of gravitational radiation. Their intermediate mass, in fact, means that they have some properties that stellar mass or supermassive black holes might not. So that's kind of interesting to speculate on. And then I'll go for some future observations and theory that might bear on this. Now, I'm going to give you some facts, but I'm also going to try to give you some speculation, hope to stimulate some discussion on this, because this is a field that has acquired a great deal of interest in the last couple of years with Chandra observations, and there's an enormous amount of work to do, of course. So the observations here, we'll talk about ultra-luminous X-ray sources, this being the first step in the intermediate mass black hole. And a lot of the salient properties of these sources are summed up in this two-panel figure from Matsumoto et al., who were looking at the star-forming galaxy M82 with Chandra. Now, M82 is a little less than 4 megaparsecs away and undergoing very active star formation. Here we have two images that were taken with Chandra about 3 months apart. And what you see are, in each case, a variety of point sources that are circled and color-coded with intensity. Unfortunately, differently color-coded. But if you were to look at this very carefully, you would be able to note that of these 9 point sources that are circled, 5 of them very significantly in their intensity. And they're bright. The brightest one here is number 7, both cases. In fact, down the bottom, it's rather bright. It's 10 to the 41 ergs per second if the flux one sees is roughly isotropic. Interestingly enough, this green circle here represents the dynamical center of the galaxy as seen with radio observations, and none of the sources are there. So our number 7, for example, is something like 200 parsecs away from the center of the galaxy. So this is fairly typical of this type of source. What you see are a variety of these odd point sources, very bright, high X-ray flux that would imply isotropic luminosities, often more than 10 to the 40 ergs per second. They're off-center, and they're quite strongly variable. And this is one of the important things that leads us to the conclusion that these are black holes of some variety, because, say, 10 years ago, a number of these sources were seen, but without establishing their variability and without the kind of angular resolution that Chandra brings to this. So there were some sources initially thought to be of this class that are, in fact, things like supernova remnants, but these are definitely not. Nor are they simply collections of lots of LMXBs together, because they would not decided to all vary by a factor of 7 in the same 3-month period. So, the argument for what the masses are. If you believe these are not strongly beamed sources, and if you believe that these are not accreting at greater, or not emitting luminosity at more than the Eddington limit for their mass, then their mass is bounded from below by between maybe 100 and 1,000 solar masses, give or take, depending on the object. On the other hand, there's also an upper limit to the mass. The fact that these are not in the center of their respective galaxies means that if they were too massive, dynamical friction would bring them into the center in a relatively short time, a billion years or so. The typical upper limits derived that way are around 10 to the 5 to 10 to the 6 solar masses. So this is the general argument by which people have proposed this is a new class of black holes in terms of their mass. Now, all good general relativity types know that black holes are really all the same as long as they have the same spin parameter. So why do we care about this particular mass range? Well, it's new and different, but in addition to that, it does have interesting possible unique properties for things like gravitational radiation, which I'll get to near the end. Now, other aspects of the observations, these definitely seem to be associated with star-forming regions, often in star-forming galaxies with high star formation rates, and within individual galaxies in things like superbubbles that are associated with large clusters, or in the case of something like M82, a lot of these have been spatially identified with superstar clusters of 100,000 to a million fairly young stars that might be just a few million years old. So that's got to be a pretty significant hint. So in addition to these sorts of things that have been seen, we heard Carl Gebhardt talk earlier about things like velocity cusps and globulars. He showed the evidence for M15, and possibly there are some other globulars that are similar, suggesting masses of maybe a few thousand solar masses in at least a few cases. And I'll certainly be interested in more observations of that type. In addition, for completeness, I should mention that there are a number of globulars around elliptical galaxies where there are point sources that have isotropic luminosities more than 10 to the 39 ergs per second. This is suggestive, but at least as far as I'm aware right now, not conclusive, because I don't think the kind of variability has been shown in those sources as is crucial for identifying some of the brighter ones that I showed you earlier. So that's a quick summary of at least the X-ray evidence for these objects. I'll now argue that these are part of dense stellar systems currently. Now, for the majority of the rest of the talk, in fact, everything past this bit here, I will, in fact, proceed assuming these are intermediate mass black holes. But there have been a lot of models proposed, and the case is not 100% clear. So the issue of these being having an upper limit to the mass, okay, fine, that's set. But the lower limit is one that comes from assumption that the X-ray flux is relatively isotropic and that you've got sub-Eddington luminosity. But it's been pointed out by Andy King in the first case and collaborators, and Mitch Begelman in the second, that these assumptions conceivably could be violated. So beaming is something that certainly happens in a number of sources. And Mitch has developed a model in which you have some clumpiness and magnetic field arrangement that might be able to sustain significantly super-Eddington accretion and luminosity. Now, that is something where we'd have to actually do binary measurements of the particular sources to clinch the mass range. So that would be wait for the future. In the meantime, however, the possibility that you've got beaming, meaning that you've got flux that is 10 to 100 times the average flux that happens to be in our direction, there have been some further developments along this line. And one of these was kindly communicated to me by Manfred Pakul, who has been doing some optical observations of a number of these sources. And here is a figure from an in-preparation paper by himself and his student Laurent Mirioni, who is currently finishing up a thesis. And the idea is that if you have these sources generating a substantial amount of X-ray flux, there will be reprocessed emission. This is an H-alpha image of one of the sources, and here's the nebula that's associated with that source. And what they've seen in a number of cases is helium-2 emission lines, which are excited by X-rays, that are isotropic as far as they can tell from the optical observations around the source, and the reprocessed emission is consistent with the X-ray luminosity, assuming this is also reasonably isotropic. Now, this means that in these cases, one can argue that you are not seeing extremely non-isotropic flux.
What's the X-ray luminosity?
The X-ray luminosity for this particular source was 10 to the 40 ergs per second. Now, one has to, of course, infer a reprocessed luminosity from a much smaller amount of luminosity that is seen in the line. So there are still things that one has to be careful about here. And one also must be cautious because nature is very complicated and could also be giving you sources like this that have a variety of different origins. For example, Andy King has pointed out that if the microquasar GRS 1915 plus 105 are pointed jet on towards us, it would look pretty much as bright as any of these sources. Okay, but I am going to proceed from now on assuming that we have indeed got intermediate mass black holes producing these ultraluminous sources. This immediately brings up a number of questions. So one is, where's it getting its matter? It's accretion powered, so where's the accreting matter coming from? It's not coming from the interstellar medium. The Bondi-Hoyle rate is too low, even if you put this in a molecular cloud. A feature here that's important is that as the luminosity is generated, it preheats the accreting matter out to a very large radius, which increases the temperature and decreases the density because of pressure balance. And this drops the maximum luminosity to 10 to the 36 ergs per second, give or take, even for a 1,000 solar mass black hole. So no luck. You'd have to have it accreting from a binary companion. The next question is, where did that companion come from? Well, it sure didn't evolve in a binary with the progenitor of this object, because if you have something that is a few hundred solar masses, it didn't come from a star born in the current universe. So it had to have been captured. But the only way that it has a chance of being captured is if you're in an environment of fairly high stellar density. So that's the argument for why it is that you would indeed expect these to be in fairly dense clusters currently. Now, as Simone discussed in his talk, there are a lot of very interesting bits of classical dynamics that go on in dense stellar systems. Now, here I'm going to define systems as having core number densities of around 10 to the 5 to 6 cubic parsecs and fairly large masses, maybe 10 to the 5 to the 6 solar masses. This means globular clusters or superstar clusters that are seen in external galaxies of much younger stars. Now, Simone talked about a number of these things. You have processes such as mass segregation, binary hardening and exchanges, where if you have an interaction between a binary and a single star, lots of stuff happens. Eventually you get a binary and a single star, but that final binary is typically going to consist of the two most massive of the three stars that originally interacted. So this means that even if you have a single black hole, for example, which is flying around, if it manages to exchange into a binary, it's more or less going to stay there. Now, in a young cluster, as Portugese, Vard, and Macmillan have explored in a few papers, you can actually have these processes produce direct stellar collisions. Now, the reason is that the most massive things around in a young cluster are the most massive main sequence stars, so they have nice large sizes. But when you talk about an evolved cluster, like a globular, then no dice, because by that point, the most massive things around are, if there are stellar mass black holes around, they're certainly the most massive. Otherwise, by not a large factor, but factor of squiggle 2, neutron stars would be the most massive in current day globulars, typically, if the main sequence turnoff is 0.8 solar masses. So you have lots of interactions of compact objects. As Simone discussed, if you restrict yourself to three-body interactions of 10 solar mass black holes or lighter, then the process of interaction and hardening of the binary will bring it together. But before it's close enough that it can merge by gravitational radiation, you end up with an ejection because the recoil is too great. The recoil speed is proportional to the orbital speed. So, and it goes, out it goes. But if you can manage to have a more massive black hole by some mechanism, maybe evolution of a low metallicity, high mass star, maybe stellar collisions, maybe lucky merger of some lighter black holes at some point, that one stays. There's enough inertia in this case that the any black hole with 50 solar masses or more will stay in the center of a typical dense cluster. So this is the sort of thing that can grow. It can produce a 1,000 solar mass object with enough interactions. Now, another thing that is of interest here and depends very much on the fraction of binary membership of black holes in the cores of these clusters is that if you have interactions between two binaries, there is an important qualitatively new outcome that can occur. That is, you can have a stable triple, which is to say that when you have a binary and single star, they can't form a stable triple if they were initially hyperbolic to each other. With binary-binary, that's what can happen, and does actually, and probably on the order of a third of the interactions that have been examined. If this is the case, and if the relative inclination of the binary and the tertiary, which is farther out, if the relative inclination is large enough, Then there's a process first examined in the context of planetary dynamics called the Kozai resonance there, where over a long period of time compared to either of the two orbital periods, the eccentricity of the inner binary goes up to a fairly high value and then back down. It's a periodic thing. Now this is interesting because it means that if the eccentricity goes up high enough, then there can be a merger by gravitational radiation without an accompanying kick. So depending on the fraction, this may mean that even the lighter black holes have a shot at merging in these clusters. And I should mention there's a poster outside by Omer Blaze and collaborators which talks about this resonance in another context, that of the supermassive black holes interacting in the centers of galaxies. Okay, so a reasonable question is, if we have globulars that have these sorts of objects there, how are we going to see them? There are a variety of things that might occur, but it's more difficult than what you might have imagined at first. So the first thing that might occur is, how about just sucking up some main sequence stars? That'd produce a nice high luminosity and be bright and be easy to see. And certainly we don't have any of those in our current globular system around the Milky Way. A problem here is that if you have a main sequence star that at some point becomes the binary partner of an intermediate mass black hole, then it will interact many times, and in the hardening process, it is very likely to interact with a more massive object, like a neutron star, in which case you would have a double compact binary, which is electromagnetically quiet. And an issue here, which is one certainly for further exploration, is whether in some clusters you have objects like blue stragglers, which are roughly the mass of a neutron star and are plenty bright in main sequence, and they wouldn't be kicked out by neutron stars. Would you expect what kind of duty cycle would you expect for the electromagnetic visibility of these systems? My sense is it would be fairly low, but to be determined. Another thing which Carl Gebhardt talked about, and may indeed have been seen, is that the presence of a massive object in the center of a dense cluster of stars will tend to produce a density and or velocity cusp. This has been examined for quite a few years. But there is an issue with these, especially for the lighter mass of this particular category, which is that wandering of the central object can be fairly significant. That is to say that as two-body interactions occur, there are going to be a lot of kicks, and so the black hole effectively undergoes Brownian motion. Now, if you restrict yourself to the two-body interactions, then if you decide that to make the cusp as sharp as possible, you need the wandering radius to be less than the radius of influence, where gm over sigma squared is for typical velocity dispersion, you would need masses more than around 500 solar masses for typical parameters. Here, by the way, this is the core radius, like in a Plummer model. If the massive black hole is typically in a binary, the kicks can be even larger, and in principle the wandering can be greater. So this won't necessarily destroy the signal entirely, but it could smear it and make it a little bit less difficult to detect. Another possibility is that it is eating gas in the cluster. Red giants are in these clusters, they have winds, so there is going to be some steady stream of gas in the globulars, and the black hole will accrete some of it. The question is, how bright would it be? And this is also an issue which is greatly uncertain. What is the accretion rate? The preheating issue again raises its head. But probably the main thing is, what is the efficiency of luminosity generation? In the ADAF-CDAF spirit, this could be extremely low, 10 to the minus 5 or less. It's very difficult to say. So the last thing I have here is an interesting possibility, because if, as I argued above, the intermediate mass black holes in globulars are typically going to have companions that are compact, then although they're magnetically quiet, they are going to emit gravitational radiation. So would we be able to see these? Any double compact binary emits gravitational waves, but let's simplify things a bit. We imagine that this binary is going to go through a lot of interactions. It'll go through encounters, harden, change the eccentricity and whatnot, and at some point it will have undergone its last encounter. So now the time to merger is less than the time to the next encounter. And so it's a pure, clean two-body system. Typically, in these globulars, you would expect the binary orbital frequency to be on the order of 10 to the minus 4 hertz, which is just edging in to the sensitivity band of LISA. Now, the eccentricity is something which is not known. Part of the problem is that you need to do simulations of a variety of encounters of high mass ratio binaries, like 100 to 1 or 10 to 1, and this is something which needs to be explored still. But in order to find out whether you're going to be able to get a high signal to noise typically, you need to do some type of population synthesis. This is not something that I have done yet. It would take a fairly concentrated effort, but at least one can produce bounds on this. Clearly, if the interaction rate is really low, then you're not going to have a chance of having one of these binaries close to merger where the signal to noise is large. That's obvious. But there are also a couple of other limits that can be placed. One is that you can't eat your mass supply much faster than a Hubble time. So, for example, let's say we're talking about interactions of intermediate mass black holes with neutron stars. Let's say you've got 1,000 neutron stars in your cluster and 1,000 solar mass black hole. If you typically are eating a neutron star once per 10 to the 6 years, then in a billion years you will have gone through your supply. So that's not consistent. Similarly, if the growth rate of the black hole is such that it would e-fold its mass in much less than a Hubble time, that's not consistent either. So these place rough limits and essentially means that all else being equal, you'd like to interact with a moderately low mass and reasonably populous series of companions if you're talking about getting the shortest merger times. So here are a couple of curves which indicate the kind of signal to noise you could get with LISA in a single year of integration, assuming that you have a binary consisting of a 1,000 solar mass intermediate mass black hole, a 1 solar mass thing that could be a neutron star or maybe a high mass white dwarf, and a distance of 10 kiloparsecs for two different eccentricities, the top being circular, the bottom being something that is almost parabolic. Now, at the lowest merger times here, to the left, the circular binary gives you the greater signal to noise, mainly because you're focusing all your signal into a single bin. But if you get to the 10 to the 6 years and larger for the merger time, the curves tend to come together. And this is actually not an accident. Indeed, if you were to do this for different masses, you would also find that you would have approximately the same signal to noise of 10 at a million years. And the reason for this is that there are compensating effects. If you fix the merger time, then you might imagine, say, the eccentricity would have a huge impact. But in fact, if you're fixing the merger time and increase the eccentricity, then you have to also increase the semi-major axis in order to keep the merger time fixed. And in the portion of the LISA sensitivity curve, which is a nice power law between 10 to the minus 4 and 10 to the minus 3 hertz, it pretty much all comes out in the wash. So merger time is your main thing. Now, if one figures this out, then with 150 globulars currently around the Milky Way, if you're assuming that some tens of percent of globulars contain these sorts of objects, then in a single year of integration, you would detect a few, several, 5, 10, something like that around in our galaxy. Interestingly enough, if you go out a factor of 1,000 further to the Virgo cluster, then since you have several hundred times as many globulars, you're also going to get roughly a few detectable in a single year integration in Virgo. Well, this would be interesting. But I was thinking recently about what one might be able to do with these. So for example, suppose that you integrate, suppose LISA has a nice extended lifetime of 10 years and you have several sources which therefore have accumulated signal to noises of 100 or more, which is pretty much what you get if you follow these curves for 10-year integration. Can you use this to do something like, say, find the distance to the cluster, to the Virgo cluster, just from gravitational radiation? Here would be the line of argument. The binary has a variety of interesting properties. It has its eccentricity, it has its semi-major axis, and two component masses. Now, if you measure the waveform, you get the eccentricity straightforwardly. If you measure the frequency of the binary, then that gives you the total mass over a cubed. If you measure the peri-Boltzmann precession per orbital period, that gives you m total over a. And if you measure the decay rate of the binary, that gives you another combination, which collectively would indeed give you everything you wanted to know about the binary, and therefore, from the measured amplitude, you could figure out the distance. Now, this is great, except for one problem. The problem is that if you look at these curves, you find that if you're talking about globulars around our own galaxy, then you're not going to have merger times typically much less than 10 to the 6 years. You simply run out of sources. And at 10 to the 6 years, that's a long enough merger time that even in 10 years, it is not realistic to imagine we could see substantial decrease in the orbital period. On the other hand, if you go to Virgo, then you have to go up to more like the 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 years, and it would have been merging for 99% of its lifetime and would be virtually circular. So you do not have the amount of information you need. But, and I'd be happy to hear other ideas, it does strike me that if one can argue that the primary interactors with these intermediate mass black holes are neutron stars with a fairly well-known mass of about 1.4 solar masses, that's enough information. So if you make this assumption and you measure several of these sources in a place where you basically have the same distance, then in principle you could be able to figure out the distance to the cluster. Now, if one then thinks about the final merger, this is not something that would be detectable with LISA because it's too high frequency for masses this small. If you go to the lower mass range of the intermediate mass, so about 100 instead of 1,000, the frequency would, however, be in the range of the proposed advanced LIGO detector, LIGO 2. So the numbers are somewhat promising. If roughly 10% of globulars have black holes of this mass range, then you'd be expecting to see something like 10 to 100 visible mergers per year. And just as an aside, it is uniquely in this particular mass range where, in principle, one could see with LISA the binary 10 years before merger and then see the final merger itself with LIGO 2, kind of a handoff between space-based and ground-based instruments. There is an endless amount of stuff to do in the future, as there usually is for these sorts of things. But here I'm just going to highlight a few of them. Something that Andrew Wilson pointed out to me, it's interesting, is that if one agrees that dense star clusters are where these things must reside to be luminous X-ray sources, young clusters, then the nature of the companion should in principle evolve with the age of the cluster. That is to say that if you imagine that the intermediate mass black hole is in the cluster from the beginning, then before mass segregation occurs, the companion is going to be typically a common object, a low-mass star. Mass segregation will proceed, and typically exchanges will make the companion more and more massive, whatever the most massive thing that interacted with that binary. Then, as the most massive stars evolve off the main sequence, it will be the most massive object left, which is to say that until you get down to stellar mass black holes, it'll still be massive main sequence objects, but as time goes on, that turnoff will drop. So in principle, it'd be interesting if one could look at star clusters containing these ultra-luminous sources and estimate ages, see if there's a correlation. I think that with respect to globulars themselves, it'd be very interesting to reobserve these sources in globulars around ellipticals to see if there's the variation that would be a convincing evidence of black hole nature. To actually make sure that the masses are in the range we need, it's necessary to make observations of binary companions and the period of the orbit. Liu and Bregman have identified what they believe are the companions of several of these objects that are B and O stars, as pretty much expected. But as far as I know, no period has yet been reported, so that would be interesting. From the theoretical standpoint, again, there's a lot of stuff to be done. I very briefly mentioned some of the four-body dynamics and things like the Kozai resonance, but one would need to go a great deal further with that. Things like what is the fraction of binaries in the core? Are the interactions typically leaving you with favorable relative inclinations? That sort of work. Even in a three-body case, the fact that these would have fairly high mass ratios, 10 to 1 or 100 to 1, means that the distribution of eccentricities, the distribution of semi-major axes after interaction, is not what it would be for equal mass. So, for example, Simone mentioned the thermal distribution of eccentricities, which is true for three equal mass objects, but not for higher mass ratios. And this matters for things like how messy an eater one of these black holes would be. Does it consume black holes efficiently, or does it throw out 100 of them before it finally manages to digest the first? Sort of handing off to the discussion of gravitational waves tomorrow, mergers of black holes that are roughly equal mass is a very challenging numerical problem. It's something a lot of people are working on now. Scott Hughes tomorrow will talk about very high mass ratio in spirals, where you have maybe a 10 to the 6 or 7 solar mass supermassive black hole and something that might be 10 solar masses coming into it. Here, you might have something which is intermediate, because unlike in that case where you're able to use first-order perturbation theory nicely, for these types of mass ratios instead, it might require additional techniques that would be very interesting to explore. And Portuguese Vard and Macmillan have pointed out, which is that if these types of objects are fairly common in the disks of galaxies, if they're generated, for example, in superstar clusters, having them fall into the supermassive black hole in the center could lead to a lot of very interesting signals for instruments such as LISA. Thank you.
Now suggests that a lot of the ULXs are seem to be associated with star forming regions.
Right, I said that at the beginning. Yes.
I mean, do you have a way of getting this model custom created?
Yes. So maybe given that, I should back up a little bit and say what I think are sort of branch points for models that they have to explore. So if these things are currently in star clusters, then the question is, were they born and grown there, or did they come from somewhere else? If they were born there, I think the main question is, can they be formed fast enough? Can they be formed within 10 million years? Which may be an issue depending on the role of primordial binaries, but it may not. If they're formed elsewhere, like in population 3 stars or globulars, how do you get them there? In our case, what we're thinking of if they're born in globulars is that it seems like about half of globulars tend to get assimilated by their host disk over a Hubble time. If they have one of these massive black holes in them, they'll tend to sink dynamically towards the center until the globular is disrupted. Then the question is, can the massive black hole encounter something like a molecular cloud? In which case, we're speculating that it would be able to induce shocks or something that would actually produce star formation there. No, because if it produces a lot of star formation near it, then it will sink dynamically and get a partner. Yeah. So that would be the issue. But, a lot of open. Right. I mean, the cluster, once the cluster is in fact disrupted, then the intermediate mass black hole basically doesn't sink any further because it isn't massive enough.
You mentioned at the beginning that alternative possibilities that some concept of being, and that when they are less than people, exactly on axis, it would be good like for sources. I think it's much better that developing well on axis will still be more or less the same, because there is no evidence for any explanation from that
Okay, fair enough. I mean, what I'm saying in general is that if you have, say, a 10 solar mass black hole that is relativistically beamed in particular, you can certainly get an enhancement of flux that's no problem at all. I mean, it'd be like a blazar.
Yeah, but unlike blazar, with events in microwave but with there is no evidence that they are data wavelengths.
Fair enough. I think also the multi-wavelength distribution would be different. I think it would be flatter than what actually sees from these sources. Yes, that's right. I mean, that's why I think that the nebular observations, assuming they mean what they appear to, if continued, are very useful ways to try to get a more robust estimate of how being there. Cool.
I actually have a question about the nebular observation. I don't know if they took a detailed model of this H2 nebula, whether healing two.
Yes.
Whether the light emission, the amount of light emission that we see, is it consistent with 40 Hertz per second isotropic?
Yes. Yes, they specifically.
Well, can we clarify that a little bit? Because what we observe is echoable. What ionizes helium 2 is 55 dB. And so to normalize the helium 2 emission line to the X-ray phenomenon requires an extrapolation of the spectrum.
Oh, indeed. Let's see. I don't remember which spectrum model they use, but of course you're right. I mean, you're ionizing things that are 20 times lower energy than what you're actually seeing. Yes, I could certainly do that, but of course Simone is an author on a paper which already does it, which is to say that the suggestion would be that, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, that if you're able to form these mass black holes in superstar clusters that can then sink and sort of release their many thousand solar mass objects near the galactic center, that they would be able to sink together, interact, and form their massive one. Is that reasonable?
Yeah, except if you're not able really to go above a few million or so solar masses. So you can do that until you build something like 2 million, maybe 5 million or so. And going to a billion, you're not going to do that.
Yeah, in this context, this is one of the themes I think would be an excellent topic for the discussion tomorrow. So if you have any more to say on this,
okay.
We might work it out.
Okay. I'm sorry, but you started with the super emitting sources. And then somewhere in between, into the middle, you said that the only way of seeing this object is by gravitational radiation. So what was the relation between the two?
Okay, so the difference is that if one of these objects is in a young star cluster, then it will form a binary with a massive main sequence star and should be quite electromagnetically luminous. You see lots of X-rays. If it's in an old cluster like a globular, then it's interacting with still the most massive things, but they're compact objects, and so you would not see them. Yes, it depends. It would depend very much on the age of the cluster that it's resident in. Yes, X-rays from graviton decay is something I haven't included in my model.
I have a bit of a chicken and an egg problem. And that is, if you have these intermediate mass black holes in young star clusters as we see them, and we now also have them in old star clusters in M15, and if you take the scenario you just sketched, like you make them in an old star cluster by subsequent mergers of stars, then at some point your star cluster dissolves but your black hole remains. And if I understand you correctly, then you think that the black hole collides with a molecular cloud and triggers the formation of a young star cluster, and that is how you get a black hole, a medium mass black hole in a young star cluster. So you first need to make an old star cluster make a black hole very slowly, then destroy the star cluster and kick the black hole into a molecular cloud to make a new star cluster. That sounds like an awfully complicated...
It may be, idea. And I think the question is, can you make things within 10 million years in the young star cluster? And if so, then it's certainly a more elegant solution to be able to do it right there. And that would not, of course, interfere in any way with these being formed in globulars, which were young star clusters to begin with. My question would be, do the existence of things like primordial binaries in young star clusters help stall the rapid core collapse enough that one would have to have a much longer time necessary to form? So that's the issue. And that's something which I think is going to be explored significantly by people like you and others. So, to be determined.
Do you have any other questions?